Welcome to The Natural Selection, where this week's theme is green. Welcome back, listeners, to The Natural Selection. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have Nick.
Hello.
We have Naomi.
Hi.
And I'm also Nick. Hello. So welcome back to another episode. This week's theme is green. But before we start, Nick, do you want to tell the audience who we are?
Yeah, I do, Nick. We are The Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who love bringing our passion for nature into the wild. And by the wild, this week we mean your earbuds. Each week we gather and we talk about the natural world. In the first section of our delightful and delicious podcast, we talk about nature news and interesting research from the past week. In the second section, we talk about our theme and how it relates to flora and fauna around the world. This week's theme is green.
Thank you, Nick. So before we begin, we usually talk about any interesting nature interactions we've had this week. Yeah, have you guys encountered anything?
I saw some more great crested grebes again. And I saw another duck that I'm trying to now look up. But I didn't get a very good look at it, so I'm not sure.
That makes it sound like it's like a really specific duck called like Andrew or like.
I also saw some baby geese, some goslings. And you know, maybe geese aren't so bad. Maybe I'll come round just a little.
Is this the summer geese when you over? The summer of geese?
Maybe. We'll see. Yeah.
Big news. Big news from Naomi there about geese. That's huge. I also saw some great crested grebes and thought of you guys because we talked about them last week and they're cute. They're nice. I did see something that I wanted to bring to the podcast, but it slipped through my mind. This is not nature. It would be interesting to you guys and at least to some of our listeners. I went to a museum for the first time in a long time this past week. It was a museum of medical anomalies that held like many, many, many jars of like weird things. It was very cool. The Museum Frolich in Amsterdam. Amazing. And they had a nice animal collection.
That does sound very Amsterdam.
There was a lamb, a cyclops lamb, which was I'd never seen before. Didn't know that could exist.
I think I went to a similar thing in Groningen. Maybe that's the thing a Dutch are into.
They were the basically the anatomists. They're like early anatomists. They were very good.
I have to say, my experience with nature this week has been somewhat depressing, really. It just sort of, all it seems to be is like, yeah, there's been insects I've been looking at. But my general experience has been looking at the news and seeing how the climate crisis is really starting to affect things. And you know those moments in time where you sort of think, I always sort of knew that humans were not going to be quick to react to this. I mean, it's been shown for our lifetimes. But it was, you know, when you think, oh, we'll only react when it's too late. And even now, when you feel like it's too late, we're not really reacting. But it feels very much like the fuse is lit.
We can hope.
Yeah. But yeah, there's been the huge heat waves in Canada and North America. Massive flooding in Germany, where we are. And even here, this summer, it's been noticeably wet where we are. And if human beings are struggling to cope with all our infrastructure, you can only imagine the sort of impact it's going to have on wildlife that are in those areas. But yeah, there was a town in Canada that had, is it 50 degree weather? Like, I think it broke Canada's record temperature by like several degrees Celsius in one time. And you think, how could wildlife possibly prepare for that?
Great shifts.
Alas. On to the news, eh?
Oh, just before we start, I think the duck I saw was a tufted duck.
Oh, that is a good ending.
Very cool.
I'm just going to have a quick Google.
Very nice headgear.
It looks like it works in Wall Street in the 1980s.
I'm into it.
It's got the grease back hair.
Yeah, and I think it was a female I saw, because I think it was all That's what confused me, because I thought that they had some white on them, but I think it was a female.
Yeah, women are confusing. They both laugh, they're just muted. But yeah, they are a beautiful black and white animal. And it just so happens that my news is about a beautiful black and white animal. I am here to talk about the great panda. I'm sure you guys remember how it got its name compared to the smaller red panda. So the great is reference to its size, not how brilliant it is. Although they are pretty brilliant, I think we'd agree. Now, what's really amazing about them is there's this sort of idea that they're unevolved for their diet, which mainly points to the fact that their digestive system is set up as a carnivore as opposed to a herbivore. But we previously mentioned that there's amazing adaptations they have to eat plant material, including their pseudothumb, which they use to grip bamboo. They've evolved a pseudothumb rather than a digestive system, which seems a bit odd. But the problem with carnivores, if you imagine a dog eating, the way they chew is not really how we chew. You sort of notice them munching up and down, even when it's sort of like dry plant-based dog food. They're not really grinding in the same way that we do. Right? It's very much up and down sort of motion. And generally, this will be a carnivore's method to sort of tear and then swallow meat. So pandas have this problem. They've got these huge canines, which they don't use for eating, but they do use in fights. The males use them in fights. What's really interesting is there's been a bit of research which was printed in Nature. And the title was Temporomandibular Joint and Giant Pandas Adaptation to Bamboo Diet. So that's a very, very long, confusing word, temporomandibular. But the mandible, you might be able to recognize, is to do with the mouth. And what this is the joint which enables our jaw to go sideways so we can grind food. And what they've noticed is that pandas grind bamboo. So they're able to move their jaw side to side so they can grind their bamboo and start the breakdown of the bamboo before it gets into their stomach, which is obviously a great way to get more energy from said bamboo. Interestingly, though, normally the giant canines would stop this lateral movement, because if you imagine canines going down, this would sort of get in the way of things. They sort of somewhat interlock. But even though the giant pandas have these big canines, they've evolved a way to still be able to do this sort of lateral movement with their jaw. So yeah, quite an amazing adaptation for pandas there.
Cool. I love this sort of like behavior, ecology, body connection.
Like, yeah.
I think that makes me most excited. Very cool.
Now, from one very large mammal to one rather small one.
Yeah, this is a heavy one. I'm talking about rats, lab rats particularly. There's some research done in Shanghai on trying to impregnate male rats. And the issue with impregnating male rats is, or male anything, is that the endocrine system of the female, the mother, is really complex. And there's many feedbacks, like hormonal feedback sort of systems in the blood and in the uterus that throughout pregnancy maintain the embryo in the uterus, which is not, those hormones aren't present and aren't regulated properly in the male in which a uterus has been implanted. But what they've done to get around this is they've taken a male rat and a female rat, castrated the male rat, and then sewn the cardiovascular systems of both rats together, creating what they call a parabiont, which is like two rats that continue living together as one for the duration of the pregnancy. And then they implant a uterus in the male rat and then implant an embryo in the uterus. And apparently about 10% of these implanted embryos worked, and these male rats gave birth by a cesarean in the end. And then they were separated from the parabiont and continued living, all of them successfully, until 3 months later when they were, like most lab rats, euthanized. So as you can understand from all of those different horrifying things that I've just described, this study has brought up a lot of ethical questions on what it means to experiment on animals and the reasons for experimenting on animals, whether or not trying to figure out if male rats can give birth is something that's worth doing this to living creatures. So that's something maybe for the comments. To talk a bit about the ethics there, but it's something in the news this week, and I thought it was at least really interesting experimental design, if not a little bit sort of like grotesque 1800s scientific experimentation that I think we moved past a while ago, but clearly we haven't. So take that with you, what you will.
Who funded that?
Apparently, someone was complaining about it, that it was taxpayer money. So some sort of public funding, perhaps. Yeah.
I don't get why female rats are already well able to do what they need to do. So like, why?
One of the possible takeaways to bring this side of it is that they, through this research, you can understand a bit better how the female endocrine and hormonal systems are playing a role in pregnancy, perhaps. But I think that that's already pretty well known.
Wow.
It seems like a classic case of they didn't stop to think whether they should.
So maybe human beings didn't really look at what their actions would lead to. There is definitely one animal that does do this.
Yes, thank you for that nice lead up. So the piece of research that I found this week was published in Science, and it was done by neuroscientists at the University of California, Berkeley. And so they were looking at kind of the idea of looking at where we are in the near future and how mammalian's navigation system can handle this. So what they did was they wirelessly tracked the brain activity of Egyptian fruit bats, and they put them in this custom flight room. And so when they had these experiments, they used a wireless neural recording device, and they monitored the bat's brain activity as they flew freely through this room. It also had cameras as well, so they could track the bat's precise flight path. And they had one set of experiments where they recorded the bat's position and brain activity while humans encouraged the animals to explore the full 3D volume of the room. And in another one, the bats were left alone and they had automatic feeders. So what they found was when they were looking at the bat's flight paths, it wasn't quite matching up with what they were expecting the location to be. So there's this thing that they found in mammalian brain. It's called place cells, and it seems to correlate with, it got quite complicated because of the neuroscience, but it seems to correlate with location, and it's part of the brain that seems to be responsible for, you know, knowing where you are location wise. And they found that it didn't seem to be quite matching up, but they could get it to match up if they matched it up with the location the bat would be in a few milliseconds. So basically these special type of neurons, these place cells, which are responsible for encoding the animal's spatial position, they were more closely correlated with where the bat would be in the near future than where they were at that moment. So hopefully that makes sense, but basically they were able to work out that the bats were thinking ahead, that they were putting themselves ahead of where they'd be as opposed to where they actually were there. So this is pretty cool. Although we kind of have known about these place cells and the basic components of this navigational system, and it's been identified in a wide variety of mammals, we don't necessarily know yet whether this ability to kind of project the path up to a second into the future is unique to bats, and because of their like rapid flight pattern, or if it's shared with like other animals. So this would be kind of up for future discovery. But it does bring up some interesting questions. And also, you know, the hippocampus, which is the area of the brain that they were looking at, it's responsible, or it can be a point of many diseases like Alzheimer's, and where a person's sense of location and memory can be disturbed. So if you're kind of looking at and uncovering these basic neural computations and how the brain is working in this regard, this gives us a better understanding of kind of disease-related impairments and things.
I think that does bring us to the end of the news. So I guess it's time for our theme. So join us after this short break, where we're about to talk about our theme, green. Welcome back, listeners. You join us now as we discuss our theme for the week, which this week is green, a very evocative colour for me, because I feel like last week blue is sort of a synonym for either very, very rude or very, very sad, which is not so good. But green seems to imply a lot of other things, including, I believe, for Americans, it means money.
Buckaroos, baby.
Yeah. For Ireland, it means home.
Yep.
And for me, it means jealousy, because, yeah, my home is England and I have no money. So I'm green with envy. But it's also a really important colour in the natural world. In fact, I would go as far to say as obviously most of the natural world is a beautiful shade of green. But interestingly, perhaps the group we're most familiar with, you don't really see very often. Isn't that right, Nick?
Yes. So I started off thinking about this week, thinking about how green is made. We talked about last week blue, like you said, Nick, and we talked about structural color versus pigmented color, and in particularly in the natural world. And the thing that we sort of, just to wrap up very quickly that whole topic from our theme last week, is that fantastic blues are made in the natural world, not with pigments, but by refracting light. Based on the way that the light bounces off the objects, it makes this sort of iridescent blue color. Blue pigment is very difficult to make. It turns out that green is also a very tricky pigment to make in the natural world, at least for animals. So animals that are green, like those, you know, those brilliant butterflies or like vine snakes, and I'm sure we'll talk about some others today, but those are the most vivid that I could think of off the top of my head. They have a lesson in color theory for us. So their greens are usually a mix of yellow pigment, which is relatively easy to make, and blue structural color, which they combine together to make green. So our eye sees it as one unified color, green, but remember from primary school or elementary school, if you're American, blue plus yellow equals green. That's how a lot of animal greens are made. And you see that in many green insects, birds, reptiles, fish. But where are the green mammals? And here I have to say, it's not easy being green for a green mammal. So let's pull apart the problem. First, do we see yellow pigmented mammals? Are one part of our equation? We have the yellow pigment and the blue structural color. Yes, it's not uncommon to see a mammal with sandy fur or even a bright yellow fur, like the yellow-throated marten. Okay, check. But what about the blue structural coloration? Not so common. In fact, there's only one mammal species that I could find that has consistently blue coloration, which is the mandrill. It's an old world monkey. It looks kind of like a baboon, and it has bright blue signal coloration on its face. And it is made... The key to the question that we're trying to figure out, though, why there aren't any naturally green mammals, is here in the face. The face of the mandrill is not the fur. The face has collagen cells, which are structured and aligned together to reflect blue structural color, in the same way that we see in a butterfly's wings. However, fur, which is made up of stringy tendrils and fibers of proteins, doesn't allow that same aligning to reflect and refract the light in a same pattern across the whole surface. So it's very difficult and, in fact, nearly impossible to make fur have a structural color. In some cases, like the golden mole that we've talked about, the one that has iridescent fur, something else is going on there. There are many little pockets of fibers along the fur. But in this case, no blue fur. And without blue, no green. So there's why we don't see many green mammals, is because most mammals have fur, and fur doesn't do structural coloration. However, there's one group of mammal that has found a way around this. And Nick, I think you might have a guess at what this one might be.
The Irish.
It's the Irish. Green.
Sloth.
It's sloth, exactly. Yeah. They have specially adapted grooves in their hair that allows them to cultivate colonies of blue-green cyanobacteria, which gives them a green appearance and helps camouflage them in the leaves of their home. Interestingly, in my research on green mammals, I found also that there was a polar bear that was known to have green patches of green fur. And people that were interested in this question did a little research, and they found that this polar bear, which was living in a zoo, consistently rubbed the same parts of its body on its enclosure, which made the hair of its body brittle and break. And polar bear fur, to keep it insulated, is hollow. So after breaking, these hollows were open to cyanobacteria, which colonized inside. So algae then colonized the inside of the hair follicles and made it look green.
That's amazing. Because, yeah, I did know that polar bear fur is technically not white, is it?
Right, it's clear.
Yeah, so that would explain why the green would really shine through. But it would be slightly disconcerting if the polar bear figured out how to blend in like, a city.
Honestly, with translucent and hollow tubules, it wouldn't be too hard to fill it with color.
You're always saying that.
I'm always saying that.
Yes, you've been consistent.
The listeners will know.
Interesting, Naomi, you actually wanted to talk about a green animal that has taken over the cities.
Yes, I did. So I actually, before I get into that, I just wanted to briefly talk about my inspiration for my idea today. So I was looking at green animals, and I wanted to bring up one animal that I feel like we talk about relatively a lot, but I wanted to talk about the kakapo, which is a flightless parrot from New Zealand. Its name is in Maori, and it means night parrot. But it's very brightly green coloured, and I wanted to kind of briefly look up why it is this. There's not that much to it, so I won't take up all that much of the topic, but basically it helps them camouflage. And like what Nick was saying, I was kind of then thinking what, as Nick mentioned, that green is usually a structural colour, but I then was kind of intrigued, kind of inspired by the blue theme as well. Is there any green pigments that we find as well in animals? And so what I found was, there is one pigment that is green, and it's found in some birds. So it's called Tura culverdin. It's a copper uroporphyrin pigment, and it gives a bright green color. And it's in several birds in the family Musophagidae, and most notably the turaco, which is worth a Google. It's a very beautiful green color. But I was then thinking about a green bird that I see quite a lot here in London. And you guys are probably familiar as well, having both lived in London for quite a while. But for anyone not familiar, there are a lot of parakeets here in London. They're the ring-necked parakeets. And when I first arrived here, I didn't realize that this was the case. And I was walking home one day and I actually saw a poster for a lost parrot or a bird or something, and I was like, oh, okay. And then I was walking home and I saw this green bird fly past, and I was like, oh, is that the lost parrot? And then I kept seeing more green birds, and I was like really confused, so I googled it. And have you guys heard any interesting theories as to where these parakeets have come from?
I heard that they were pets that got loose.
Okay, what... yeah. Mm-hmm.
I heard that specifically they were someone's pets that got loose.
Yes, I think you may be touching on what I'm going to talk about here. So they're non-native birds. They're native to Africa and India. And so one popular myth or origin story for this is that Jimi Hendrix released a mating pair in the 1960s. Or perhaps it wasn't him, but they actually escaped the set of the Humphrey Bogart movie, The African Queen. Or maybe a storm damaged an aviary in the 1980s. So there's lots of different ideas, but wherever they came from, there are a lot of them now. So the first original sighting of them was in Dulwich in 1893, and then there was some seen in Brixton in 1894, and a breeding pair were reported in Epping Forest in 1930. And then in the late 20th century, there was the first large colony. And it was established, and it was roosting in the trees by the river at Kingston-upon-Thames. And maybe 10 years ago, there's been a really great expansion, and they're all over the place now. So I couldn't find an exact estimation, but they seem to be widespread across many of London's parks. And they do relatively well here for a non-native bird. And, you know, there's some people who are doing research on it, and it is an interesting topic that, you know, hopefully we can maybe find some more work on. And kind of like, what are they doing? What, like, damage are they causing? Are they causing damage? Like, are they affecting indigenous species? Nothing that I could find specific answers at the moment, but maybe we can, in a couple of years, I'm sure research about this will come out.
I'm very familiar with them. They make a lot of noise.
They do. I was actually going to put in like a little sound clip of them as well, because I was going to ask you guys to be like, what is this? But I forgot.
For such a beautiful bird, they make a hell of a racket. It's not a pretty song.
It's not a pretty sound, no.
I still remember I was on the M25 once, because I live a really exciting life. And for anyone who's not from the UK, the M25 is a traffic jam, basically, that goes around London. And I saw one in Essex. I saw two in a tree in Essex. And when I checked online, there was no indication that they had got that far before. So that was quite intriguing. So it appears even now they are still spreading their range. But there's loads of them in Kew Garden. And they're very easy to spot there if you do want to find some in an interesting setting.
They're newly arrived in Amsterdam.
Really? Wow.
I saw some this week.
Oh, wow.
They're spreading.
Yeah, that's not good. It's good for them. Well done, then. Well, speaking of Amsterdam, I did think what green meant to me, in especially in relation to nature, you know, that idea of green being environmental or things like that, or environmentally friendly, at least, or something, the greenest animal. But I did come to the conclusion that I do live in Berlin, and for most of the population here, if you ask them about green, they would think you were talking about a very specific plant. While most plants are green, in Berlin, I feel green is always going to be cannabis. And it's an interesting plant with an amazing cultural history relating to humanity. So it's got an amazing evolutionary history, for one, because we've never found a fossil of it. But we know it's about 30 million years old. And we're almost certain that it evolved on the continental mass of Eurasia, because that's where historically that it appeared, first of all, sort of in the history textbooks and things like that. And there appear to be two main divisions of this sort of cannabis plant. The first one being the one that you are probably imagining now, which is the one that people smoke now to elicit a high. But do you guys know the other one?
No.
Well, it's used to make fiber. It's hemp.
Yes. Yeah, as soon as you said fiber, I was like, yes.
They're exactly the same species. There's no difference between them. The only difference is really, and this isn't essential, actually, I don't believe. So generally, the plants which are used to create hemp and fibers have less of the chemical tetrahydrocannabolic acid, which becomes tetrahydrocannabinol, which is THC, which you might hear people talk about. But they tend to have a bit more cannabolic acid, or CBD, which you can now buy in shops, at least in Berlin. Yeah, so there's an amazing history of humanity and hemp. But what this makes it really difficult culturally is to sort of spot when people were using these sort of as a psychoactive compound and when they were using them as a structural compound. Because we know, for example, that hemp ropes were used to move the Easter Island statues. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
We also know that throughout history, they were used a lot in Egypt as well as hemp, and that clothing had been made out of them for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the earliest recorded, I think, farming of them is about 10,000 years ago. So they're incredibly early farmed, which would make sense if they were being used for clothing and structural things rather than as a psychoactive compound, but we just don't know. But there's a grave in China that's thousands of years old, and the man was buried, but on top of him lay like a blanket of cannabis leaves. So it appeared that this was a really important thing, but was it important because it was a hemp sort of symbolizing clothing or something like that? Or was it important because it's a psychoactive compound? This may have some relation with death ceremonies and things like that, but we just don't know. It probably, the estimates at the moment is that they might have evolved in Central Asia. Some people are even confident enough to say that perhaps it was on the Tibetan plateau was where it first evolved. They do this because of plants that it's generally found next to now evolved there as well. So they're sort of making the guess that perhaps this was where these pressures acted on both these plants. But they come from the Cannabaceae family, which includes cannabis, which there are either one, two or three species. Taxonomists can't decide. The most famous one is Cannabis sativa, but there's also Cannabis indica. And then perhaps a third one, which is native to Eastern Europe, which doesn't sort of get you high, which is called Cannabis ruderalis. But they also might just be one species. Now, interestingly, they're from the family Cannabaceae. Do you know what other type of plant are in this family? And we use them to make something else, which could be considered, I suppose, a psychoactive compound.
My guess is like tea or something.
It's a good guess. It's not.
Is coffee in the same family?
It's hops.
Oh.
So yeah, hops are cannabis's cousins, and we use them to make beer. Now, the big question is, why would cannabis bother making this compound which gets us high? It's sort of an odd thing for a plant to do. Well, the truth is, what it's probably making is an insecticide. Insects have a lot simpler nervous system than we do. So for us, when it might just act as sort of something which acts as psychoactive and gives a sort of potentially a pleasant high, for insects, it could be deadly. And there are other chemicals that we enjoy, not necessarily for our benefit, but have the same effect. So nicotine is an insecticide that we use and smoke in cigarettes, which is what makes cigarettes addictive. Caffeine is another one. Caffeine is surprisingly deadly. You know, if you have an asthma attack, sometimes they put you on a theophylline drip in hospitals. And because these group of chemicals are so deadly, they sometimes don't let you have a cup of coffee if you're on this, because the added caffeine could actually trigger an overdose and kill you.
Cool.
So for insects, caffeine is especially deadly, which is why things like tea and coffee both make it, to keep the insects away. Sadly for them, it just attracts humans. But then I suppose we plant it elsewhere, so who knows if it's good in the long run. Tea's done very well out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's really winning there?
Yeah. But yeah, that does bring me to an end of cannabis. I thought I'd end on a high. Now, one animal that would probably confuse the hell out of you if you were on cannabis is one that would just change color in front of your eyes. But that's what you wanted to talk about, isn't it, Nick?
Good transition, Nick. Yeah, I was thinking, what's green? What's green? And obviously, I couldn't just do something like, I don't know, plants. No. So I wanted to do something a little bit wild. So I picked something that changes color, but has green in there quite often, chameleons. They're one of the better known land animals that change colors, but they have a really peculiar way of doing it. People thought for a long time that it was that their color change was via dispersion of pigment containing organelles, so moving around these pigments in their skin. However, some research conducted a few years ago on particularly panther chameleons shows that the pigment movement does happen, but it only represents part of the mechanism of color change in chameleons. So apparently what has escaped research before is that the skin of chameleons is made up of two superimposed layers, one very thin on top of the pigment-containing layer. And the thin overlayer is a layer of a lattice of guanine nanocrystals, which I thought was pretty sci-fi and pretty cool. But basically, these two skin layers together control color and thermoregulation. So when this nanocrystal lattice is excited, the spacing between the nanocrystals changes. When those changes happen, the wavelengths of light that are reflected and absorbed change. So then the color changes that's being reflected and refracted off this nanocrystal lattice. So in a relaxed state, the nanocrystal layer reflects blue and green because the wavelength of light that gets reflected is higher. But in an excited state, they reflect longer wavelengths of light, yellow, orange, and red. In many chameleons, though, and this is the part that sort of I thought was interesting and brings us back to our topic, the layer of skin without crystals, the pigment-containing layer, contains many yellow pigments that don't move around so much. So they have this base yellow layer. But if you look at chameleons in the wild, most of the ones, at least those that live in green areas, don't have yellow skin. And this is because in the relaxed state, the yellow pigments combine with the blue in the relaxed lattice and results, like we heard in the mammal topic earlier, in the green color that many chameleons have in their relaxed state. So when you see a chameleon that's red or orange or yellow, it's usually because they're anxious or excited or angry or something. But when you see them just chilling, just green, it's usually because they're relaxed and that blue structural color in their nanolattice is combining with yellow pigment in their skin.
That's clever.
Isn't it? I thought that was pretty cool.
They're really funky animals anyway. They're one of those animals that I almost don't want to research because it's just like they're a color-changing thing with a rocket-powered tongue which can move its eyes independently. Yeah, I don't want to know.
And the two little blep blep with their feet, you know, that are, you know.
Yeah, its feet look like they were lazily drawn by a child.
Yes. Yeah, I love them. I love them.
And that teeny tiny chameleon as well.
Oh, the one on the thumb that you see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Makes me sick.
Yeah, a contender for the smallest vertebrate is a chameleon. I do know that David Attenborough was telling a story that when he was early producer of television, he was creating a documentary about Madagascar and he had this car and he didn't want anyone to steal the car, which was sort of difficult if it didn't have sort of like doors or windows. So what he used to do is he found a chameleon and he used to leave the chameleon on the steering wheel. And there's a belief in Madagascar among some people that a chameleon is an omen of death. So when the chameleon was in a car, no one ever stole it.
Convenient. But what if the chameleon leaves?
Then I don't think they're that mobile, are they? And they don't know how to drive.
They don't know how to drive, that's true.
So from a very famous green animal, I kind of feel we've neglected most of the green that exists. And Naomi, I think you're here to address that balance.
I felt like we couldn't have an episode about the color green without talking about plants. And so I decided to talk about chlorophyll. Then I realized that it's very complicated. So I'm going to give a basic version because that's what I can understand. The whole ins and outs of everything is very complicated. And I, as you know, I'm not a botanist or a biochemist. So some of it went over my head. But what chlorophyll does in the plants, one, well, it gives it its green color, but chlorophyll acts to and absorbs energy from the sun. So chlorophyll absorbs photons, and then what happens is an electron gets excited, and this causes a chain reaction, and this energy is then used to combine carbon dioxide and water into sugars. And this is the process of photosynthesis. And there's two types of chlorophyll that are found in green plants. The two main types, really, are called chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. And they differ really kind of only in their structure. So in the, they have a different side chain in their chemical makeup. And so they're very effective photoreceptors. And they're good at absorbing colors of light. So chlorophyll A can absorb light at around 435 nanometers, which is blue violet, and also 670 to 680 nanometers, which is red. B instead can absorb wavelengths of about 480 nanometers and 650 nanometers. So 480 is blue and 650 is orange. And so green algae also has chlorophyll A and B, but red algae has chlorophyll A, but also chlorophyll D. And brown algae instead has chlorophyll C. So lots of different types of chlorophyll there. And the reason that it is green is because it's absorbing the blue and the red light. Yeah, so chlorophyll is really important for plants as it acts as a photoreceptor and allows plants to make their own food and be autotrophs, and also allows us to eat those plants.
Which I do with glee. As you mentioned, Naomi, chlorophyll presents as green to us. And plants are the overwhelming backdrop to nature, which means there's quite a lot of selective pressure for animals to look green, which why they exist. But I suppose for both of us, we have that instinct of going to birds. But I wanted to pick a more local bird to me, and I believe to you, but not to Nick, which is the green woodpecker. Now, I really like the green woodpecker because while it's a common bird, it's of least concern, it's not endangered in any way, it always felt like a treat seeing one because it's green and it's not just a pigeon or anything like that. It was a woodpecker, and they do really strange things. You can hear them from a long way away. You can even hear them walking through the parks of Berlin. So it is difficult to identify which woodpecker is which when they're woodpecking, but the green woodpecker has a really distinctive call. And it sounds, the best way I can describe it, like Jimmy Carr's laugh. It sounds like the most annoying laugh in the world, which leads to its other name, which historically was called a yaffle. And it's thought that that was an onomatic peeing of like, yaff, 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 yaff. Interestingly, in the TV show Bagpuss, if anyone's familiar with that, there is Professor Yaffle, the wooden bookend, which is based upon a green woodpecker. Now, I did look on Wikipedia, and you know sometimes where Wikipedia are like, wow, and it's really well sourced, and then other times you think, I think someone was just having a bit of fun on Wikipedia. I kind of feel with the alternative names for green woodpecker, someone was having a bit of fun, because the lists that they've given includes Laughing Betsy, Yaffingale, Yappingale, and Jack Eichel. Other names including Rainbird, Weathercock, and Wetbird. But interestingly, historically, there is an association with green woodpeckers being able to bring on rain, which I'm not exactly sure what I was trying to think about. I was to speculate. I had two main ideas. One, I thought maybe the beating of the wood does sound a bit like the falling of rain. I mean, it's much louder, so I don't know whether that would be associated. But, you know, like rain sticks you get, and that idea of mimicking rain, I thought maybe it's that. But I did wonder if it was to do with his eating habits, because what do green woodpeckers eat?
Bugs. Sorry, no. Insects.
Yes.
Do they eat like grubs or larvae?
Well, this is it. So most woodpeckers eat things on a tree, right? Green woodpeckers don't. Green woodpeckers overwhelmingly eat ants. I think the RSPCB defined it as ants, ants, and more ants, which is why they will often visit your lawn. And I was thinking this is by far and away the most common woodpecker I've seen, and it may just be that they're easy to spot because they land in the middle of grass looking for ants and you can see them. I did wonder if this is why they'd evolve to be green, because they would spend so much time on the ground as opposed to the spotted woodpeckers, which have to blend into trees. But yeah, they will eat a vast amount of ants. And because of that, they have one of those creepy long tongues. You know the ones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. With barbs at the end.
Oh, it's, yeah, I don't like it. I don't like it.
The kind that when they pull them back in their skulls, it wraps around the backside of their brains to cushion them from the impact.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know it. You know it. So why are they banging on trees? Seems like an odd thing to do if you eat ants, right? Well, they build their nest in trees. They will dig a hole in a tree. Quite often, a green woodpecker hole is actually quite low down, but they can build them at the top of trees as well. And these holes can be used for up to 10 years by woodpeckers, but not necessarily by the same breeding pair. So perhaps others will move into an existing hole and things like that. But yeah, I just thought I wanted to talk about green woodpecker because they always felt like a little treat whenever I saw one in the garden. And so anyone in Europe, I think they range all the way, in fact, to the Middle East. But anyone listening from those areas, keep your eyes open for a lovely woodpecker, because apparently they don't migrate very far, because they generally don't go more than 500 meters away from where they breed in the breeding season. Amazing Latin name. Amazing Latin name. Big fan of this. Big fan of this. Because their Latin name is named by Carl Linnaeus, is Picus viridis. Do you know what that is in Latin?
Something green.
Green woodpecker, yeah. Absolutely love that. Nice and easy. Bish, bash, bosh. And on that pleasing note about an excellent name, we must end. We'll be back next week, though, so don't panic. And next week's theme, to perhaps round off our exploration through the rainbow, is red.
It's not easy being red. No, it's easier being red. Don't leave us on red.
But for this week, from all of us here at The Natural Selection, it's goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Well, because they can either get way too complicated or just be, like, painfully basic. So I went for painfully basic.
Well, Amy, you are painfully basic.
I know. But, yeah.